Okay, here we go. So the first thing I'm going to do is hand out two flyers, and I want to explain them and plant the seed here and talk to you about why I'm handing out two. This is for the Clinical Ethics Mediation Workshop that we now do here at Penn as part of the Penn Mediation Program. We're having some trouble getting the word out for folks who are not part of our listserv, so we're asking instructors this week to talk about it. And the reason I'm handing out two is because they're each structured differently. They are each a half credit, and when you put them together, they're a credit. Now, the reason that you should do this is because they're fantastic, and if you have anything to do with patients or families or conflicts between providers in any of that in your work or will, then this is the skill set of conflict resolution that is known as mediation, and it's very similar to the Harvard Negotiation Project. Mediation and negotiation are kind of synonymous words. And that is, of course, why you should do it, because it is a very key skill, and there is no place in the U.S. that teaches this on a clinical side. Harvard Negotiation Project teaches it for about, $30,000, and that's for how to negotiate between Israel and Palestine. But if you want to negotiate shared solutions at the bedside, then we're really the only game in town, and the town is the U.S. Nancy Dubler and Carol Liebman have a certificate, that's what they call it, a week-long program that they do in New York, but you don't get actually much hands-on, and in this one, you actually do nothing but hands-on. It's all simulated games with videotaping and actors and every other thing. And that is, of course, why you ought to do it. But here's also why you should do it from a self-interested perspective that is not noble, but hell, we're in consequentialism today. Anyway, if you put these two things together, two weekends, it's a whole course, there's no reading, and there's no paper. So if you're looking for a course, put these two together and get yourself a course. Now, the other reason that I'm trying to push this now is because we're starting to bottleneck for the later intensives. So quite a bit of room in March, not much in May, probably won't have any room in August, but the people who take it in March are gonna wanna take May and August and they get first dibs. So if you want in, you should probably grab it. This takes place spring break, and it's a Wednesday, Thursday evening, and then a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. This one in May is a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. If you're worried about tuition benefits covering it from the med school or the law school, we can register you early for the May one if you're going to be around so that it still is in the spring semester. So I'm going to pass out both. If you're interested at all, take them. If you think you know people who are interested, pass them on and send them to me. And there we go. And that's why there's two. Okay. All right. Onward to today. Let me talk a little bit, first orienting us, where are we in the semester? Probably we're not lost yet, because this is week three. But let me give you the, here's how we're doing it, here's where we're going. Remember that the first half of the class is divided between a focus on consequentialism and a focus on deontology, though dialectically we are engaging in both at the same time to clarify one through the other. And today, and each one of those, consequentialism and deontology, has the structure of the classical articulation, the modern day articulation, and an applied piece. So today we're talking about Philip Pettit, who's at Princeton, and next week we will be talking about his colleague, Peter Singer, for the applied piece. And we are focusing in the consequentialist section of the course on ACT consequentialism, though both Mill and Philip Pettit have something to say about the role of rule consequentialism, so we will revisit that a little bit today. So today we're going to talk about the modern articulation, but I want to say something about where we're getting it from and how peculiar it is probably for you to think that the reading for today came from something that looks like an encyclopedia. So, for example, I'm the editor of one of the editors of the Penn Center Guide to Bioethics, and while I recommend you all buy it right away, of course, discounted on Amazon, it is not the kind of thing that you would have some PhD wasting her time trying to explain to you over 2 hours. Not any. As fabulous as those are, and you know that it won two big awards, the Choice Award and the Prose Award, so it was a great collection. Nevertheless, you wouldn't need this kind of energy and dedication for any one of the 72 pieces in that encyclopedia. So why exactly are we looking at the Companion to Ethics, the Blackwell Collection, for our modern day articulation of consequentialism? An excellent question indeed, because it does seem like a strange source, unless, of course, you actually tried to do the reading today, and then you know exactly why I'm up here for 2 hours trying to explain it. Because this is, of course, an encyclopedia about philosophy. But philosophers don't actually know how to take off their philosopher hat where they're talking to other philosophers and actually try to talk to someone who doesn't have a PhD in philosophy. So this thing actually turns out to be very, very high level and abstract and pretty much so dense that if you don't have a PhD, you can't really make heads or tails out of it. That's why I've got the little, at a certain point, you just have to scream. When he gets into the options and the prognoses, this thing gets even more dense, though it doesn't start out too easy either. So I wanted to explain to you why we use this. This entire collection is basically a who's who of 20th century, so it was written, you know, about 15 years ago, who's who of 20th century philosophers speaking to each other and trying to convince each other that the kind of ethics they do is best. So they're really not encyclopedia-esque. So wanted to let you know, Cambridge, the Blackwall Companion, it's actually edited by the Peter Singer, not the one at Toronto who's famous in bioethics, but the one at Princeton, and this thing is not the kind of idiot's guide to philosophy that you might hope to get, try to straighten out some of the questions you have in this class. Okay, that is why we are reading the piece we're reading today. Why I'm explaining why we're reading it, and now why are we actually reading it at all? Because I don't think there's a better articulation in a short amount of space than that one about consequentialism. It gives us an extremely novel way of thinking about act consequentialism. And I think thinking about the terminology in this rendition, which is completely consistent, absolutely, with Mill, but very different in its language, gives us another completely different perspective, and I think will really sharpen our understanding. And by that I mean the way he starts off with the theory of the good versus the theory of the right, probably impenetrable, but hang on. The way that he engages us in the contrast between a teleological and a non-teleological theory, then his introduction of the terms promoting and honoring, which I think tell a great deal of the story about the difference between Kant and Mill, or consequentialism and utilitarianism. Then he takes us into this strange probability section with options and prognoses. But another, in this section, perhaps an overly abstract way of understanding how actions get their value, how they're understood to be right or wrong in consequentialism, but when explained, I think actually very handy. And then he's going to entertain two critiques that he knows the deontologists have at the ready, and we'll listen, see what he thinks, what we think of his responses. And then I think he dives into the abyss, where he tries to talk about rule consequentialism as the process you would engage in deliberatively, but act consequentialism as the process you would engage in as a justification, probably not making it much sense yet about that, but in the end I'm going to try to argue, as I did last week, that to try to be a combo, act and rule utilitarian at the same time, to me is very muddy, and I can't make sense of it, and I couldn't make sense of it when Mill said it either, so I don't have it in hand either when Philip Pettit says it. To me, the guy's an act consequentialist, and we will see. So that's where we're going. Any questions so far to start? All right. Then let's have a sip of tea and proceed. Philip Pettit is not the first person to talk about the distinction between theories of the good and theories of the right. In fact, the way that he goes about this, he's actually taken a famous argument from a deontologist, John Rawls, we'll read him in a couple of weeks, and tried to extend this argument so that he could have all theories looking like they could be compared in a parallel way, and Rawls would vehemently disagree. But nevertheless, to bring in this idea of theory of the good and theory of the right, I think does help us. And let me tell you what he's trying to do here. So first, what Pettit is saying, then a little bit of what Rawls is saying, adding the two together, I think we really get a good distance here. The good, which is often capitalized when we're talking about it in this way, is that which is of the highest value according to the framework that one is dealing with. What is the ultimate universal good most valuable? I'm going to use the word thing here, but it's not a great word, in human life. And in consequentialism, it's very clear that when you understand the good, you understand that it is that to which all actions head or strive. We'll talk in a second about the way that Pettit tries to make deontology have such a thing as the good, but it's a little bit of mental gymnastics to fit deontology into this paradigm. But on the consequentialist side, it actually makes perfect sense. If you think about what is of highest value for a consequentialist or a utilitarian, you would say what? Happiness, right. So for consequentialism, it is happiness of some variety. And that could be the maximization of pleasure and pain, pleasure and reduction of pain. It could be well-being. It could be welfare. It could be utility. But all of it is a version of happiness. And consequentialism has as its structure the view that whatever we do in our lives, it should be driving towards happiness, towards the ultimate good. It is a theory of the good. It is a theory where the good in human life, the most valuable thing, is of central importance, and it defines the good as something like happiness. The right are what those things, what agents, moral agents, those are people, ought to do. This is Philip Pettit, to achieve the good. So when you know the good, I'm still going to stay in consequentialism because to translate this into deontology, as I said, is going to take us some mental flips. But when you know what the good is, then that is right that delivers the good. This is actually an abstract way of saying what you probably have already surmised, and we could put it like this: this is an end, this is a means, and consequentialism is the theory where the ends justify the means. When you know what is good, what the good is, either in a particular way, what would make most people happy right now, or just in general, that's a specific example of the good, but the good itself, human happiness, then what you ought to do in your day-to-day actions as you're deciding how you ought to live is what will deliver and bring about the good. And that, in consequentialism, we will call right action. If, in the case of the kid in the wading pool, not liking him that much, that's true, but if we can understand that his life being saved, perhaps inclusive of your reward, but nevertheless, that kid being saved plus your reward and the whatever the all the praise that you're also going to get is good, then what is right to do in the situation is to get the kid out of the pool because it will deliver and bring about the good. But first, you need to know what is good. And then you will know what is right. When you know the ends, then you will know the means. But what is prior, what is first, what is most important in this entire mechanism, in the entire way that we come to understand our moral calling, I'm not going to say duty, because of course that's a deontological word, the whole structure of it is get a handle on what's good, and whatever will bring it about is what you ought to do. The right is what you ought to do. What John Rawls said prior to Philip Pettit is that the good in consequentialism is defined first. And you define, understand, figure out what is right in terms of the good. Once you know what the good is. So the good comes first, and then you figure out the right. The right is defined in terms of the good. After you know the good, then you can figure out what you ought to do. That's why you don't say something like, well, should I betray the person or not betray the person? There is no way to understand what you ought to do unless you first understand where will the good be maximized. And when you know what would produce the greatest happiness for the greatest number, you go back this way, and maybe the arrow is confusing. Let's put it this way. Once you know what will maximize the greatest happiness for the greatest number, then you know what you ought to do. You ought to do that which will do that very thing, will bring about the greatest good for the greatest number. Now, this may all seem very obvious as a method of understanding consequentialism, but what's going to be very helpful is that the deontologists think about it in the exact opposite terms, in the exact opposite way. Before I tell you that, though, I want to talk to you about why Philip Pettit goes down this path talking about the teleological versus non-teleological theories. And this was really something that Rawls articulated to try to differentiate consequentialism and deontology. Let's think about this. We're not even close on the spelling of this word. One eraser to our name. Teleological comes from the Greek word telos, which means end or goal. A teleological theory is a theory that is driving towards some goal or good. A theory, a framework that drives towards an end or goal. So you can see from this definition that consequentialism is a teleological theory. It drives towards the good. It is trying to figure out what is good, and once it does, whatever means it takes to get it is what you ought to do. But it's always keeping in view the good as the central end, as the summum bonum, as that which all things need to head. And anytime you have something that is driving towards a particular end, of course, backed by the general end of the good, of happiness, you have a teleological theory. And that helps us understand why deontology is understood very clearly as a non-teleological theory. And I'm going to show you how deontology does not consider the end at all. It is not driving towards any goal at all. Though I'll show you in a minute how Pettit tries to squeeze deontology to say that every theory has a good and every theory has a right. I think that the stretching makes so little sense of deontology, it's no longer helpful or intuitive. But I will talk about how deontology understands the relationship between what is good and what is right. Okay, run out of board, and I gotta get an eraser. Okay, let's look at deontology for a second. For deontology, you start with What is right? What is the right thing to do? And you understand the right thing to do based on what your duties are. And first then, you nail down what is right. Should I betray? Should I not betray? Well, thou shalt not betray. Don't betray. That's what's right. And once you know what it is that's right to do, that is good. That is the highest thing to achieve in human life. But first, you figure out what's right. And when you're doing what is right, that's when the action has the ultimate good, which we'll hear about in 2 weeks. There is nothing of purer good, of the highest good in human life than acting rightly, than doing what is right. So you don't try to figure out what's good and then whatever it is will deliver the right. You figure out, where's my blue, what is right, and then that just is what's good. That is the highest good. Go ahead.
So in consequentialism, there was a right and that was an action, and the good, as far as I can understand, was like a unit. There's like happiness or like whatever you want to put there.
A goal, let's say. The good is the goal of happiness.
And to me, it sounds like it's different than the action.
It is.
It's what you're going to, it's the goal of the action.
Right.
But in deontology, it's...
Good is when people act rightly.
Okay.
That's the whole deal. There is nothing good apart from pure moral action. Right. Pure moral action is what's right. And when you have what is purely right action, you have what is good in human life. There is no other good. And that's why deontology isn't heading towards anything. This is an equal sign. There is no teleology. There is no heading towards a goal or an end. This is the entire thing right here. You've already achieved it. When your duty is to not betray and you don't betray, you have already achieved the good, because the good is when human beings act morally. It's the same thing. There is no telos that you're heading towards. This is the thing in itself, the everything you're trying to do in human life. Morally. Act correctly. Act according to duty. And you already have achieved the human good. Because for Kant, there is nothing so pure as when human beings are acting according to duty, sometimes even subverting their own self-interest to achieve this duty that they impose upon themselves. Nothing is more beautiful, more good, more perfect. Pure good. And that's what Kant calls the good. And he will start off one of his sections by saying, nothing in human life is of any higher value than human beings acting on moral duty. That is the good. Mm-hmm.
So, but your duty can't be, you know, to make sure that everyone's happy.
No, but sometimes you do have one duty that looks a little bit like that. You have a duty to help others. You do. You have a duty to promote the human happiness, right? But I'm going to talk to you about this in a minute. It is what we call an imperfect duty in Kant. It is not a perfect duty, and all that means is you have a lot of choice. You've got a lot of wiggle room about how you fulfill that duty. You don't have to just do one thing. Sacrifice all of your money to save the poor in the somewhere on the continent of Africa or whatever. Yes, there is an obligation to care for your fellow beings in some capacity, but you get to choose when and where and how much. So there is this duty, but it doesn't have for one thing, it's a very small scale. The bar in consequentialism is much higher than the lazy bar of deontology in terms of what you owe other people. Deontology is much more minimalist in what you owe other people. But the other thing is, because you're not driving towards that as a goal, and that's a big difference, it is the right thing for me to do when I help other people. But by the fact that I've already helped other people, like for example, I was on a bus and I saw somebody needed the chair and I got up, done. I've already achieved the right. right there. If I'm a consequentialist, I have to think, what would maximize the good in any situation? And then that's right. This, standing up like that and saying, oh, you couldn't have the chair. Did anything get maximized? Because until I know, I'm not going to be able to call that right. I have to know if I'm really getting at the core, if I'm driving towards the good, before I can define as right. Actions in deontology are defined as right according to moral duty. And as long as you do them, it doesn't even matter if you bring about any human happiness at all, because that's not part of the equation. I am already achieving the good when I act according to duty, the right.
So if the person didn't sit down, you'd still be doing the right.
Yes.
Yes,
let's say the person was like, oh no, I'll be fine. My offer already got me all the moral credit I need in deontology. Right, now I don't have to say, well, let me find somebody else who will sit there. No, done. I already did achieve the good. The most sublime, that's how Kant will talk about it, the most sublime feature of human life is human beings acting on duty. That is all the good there is when we're talking about morality. Now, Kant isn't going to say that it's not good to be happy, but there's an equivocation there on the word good. There's good in a non-moral sense, like it's good to have a vanilla milkshake. Better if it's an eggnog milkshake. That is good. That is not morally good. And that's why we get the whole capitalization thing going.
So is it fair to say that deontology is more rigid than consequentialism? In terms of duty, like, you know, for example, are all deontologists pacifists?
Two very good and different questions. They sound like they're the same and they're not. Kant appears extraordinarily rigid until thinkers like Barbara Herman lighten him up a little bit. So no doubt about it, there is a rigidity to deontology, which we're going to see as soon as we get to promoting versus honoring. We're going to see an absoluteness about deontology that is fair to say is akin to rigidity at first pass. And there are certainly aspects of deontology that are very rigid. There's a long story that goes behind the rigidity, but let me give you a preview of it. I feel like lying. That's the rigidity. Right. No, you can't lie. That's different from, because what am I saying? I feel like it. It will serve me. I have a selfish interest in lying. No wiggle room. That's what perfect actually means. Rigid. Absolute no wiggle room. No. But let's imagine that I am called to save a life, but it will require a lie, but I'm also called not to lie, but then somebody will die. Now deontology just stands there mute, saying there is an absolute command on you not to lie. There is an absolute command on you not to let someone die. I don't know how you're going to solve it. There's where the flexibility comes. But that there are two duties that are perfect, rigid. Okay. Now, pacifism is the second question, and that just appeals to this second aspect. In other words, are there two competing interests on you? So do you have a duty to protect your country, and do you have a duty not to hurt anyone? Yes. What do you do? I don't know. Some deontologists will say I'm a pacifist, and some deontologists will say I'm the captain of the Air Force on the same grounds, because two obligations are competing for my time. But neither of them is selfish and self-interested. It's when duty is up against self-interest that the rigidity is very clear and absolute. But that will not be true in consequentialism. It will be maximally flexible. So yes and no to your question, but absolute no rigidity in consequentialism.
So there ends up being equipoise in both deontology and consequentialism. It's just
yes.
Consequentialism is more downstream.
Yes, because that's called human life.
Right.
And it would be weird if a theory tried to deny moral conundrum when we know that there is moral conundrum. So if a theory didn't reflect that back to you, then you'd know you were just wasting your time here. Alrighty. So, when we are thinking about deontology, we get a hold of what is right, and we've already got the good. No goal, not teleological, not driving towards something beyond what is right action. It is right action. It does not have a goal, and it most certainly doesn't understand anything about the ends justifying the means. What end? The means are the whole deal. When you have the right means, morally, that's the end. That's the end of the story, that's the goal, that's the whole deal. So it can't even make sense of the ends justify the means. This can only be a thought of consequentialism, because ends and means are the same thing when it comes to morality. And if the means aren't good, I don't know what you're doing with the end, because the only means that matter is act morally. And means is when you act morally. That's when you have the right means. So you can't split them like that. In consequentialism, you absolutely can. And obviously, a lot of people think so, because we all know this phrase. And deontologists don't know how they just stutter over it. Okay, now I do want to tell you what Philip Pettit was saying about the theory of the good and the theory of the right, and everybody's got a theory of the good and blah, blah, blah. This is actually, I think, a better understanding of deontology versus consequentialism. But you know how sometimes people want to say, we really are all the same with just slight differences? Pettit is trying to say that structurally, ethics can be understood, ethical frameworks can be understood to make the same moves, it's just that they have different particular content when they're making that move. Fine. But here's what you have to do to deontology, which kind of defeats the whole main strategy and understanding of deontology to make this work. Pettit argues that there is another good that you could understand morally correct action driving towards, in which case you could understand deontology as actually having an end. And the end, the goal, the good that he thinks deontology has, and in a way it does, except it's not very helpful, is achieving perfect human freedom. So abstract, I'm not sure I want to write it down. I don't mean you're not in jail, you're not a slave, your mother's not telling you what to do. I don't mean freedom in that way. I will tell you this because it will help us when we get to Kant to see how extraordinarily abstract Kant is. Human freedom isn't the absence of coercion from other people. That's how we normally think about freedom. Freedom, it's a couple of weeks from now we'll really delve into this, but freedom is when a human being can impose on herself obedience to her own moral conscience. And when she does, she is free. So you could be a slave and free, and you could be in jail and free, and your mother could be telling you what to do and you're free, as long as when you act to not lie or to not betray, you're acting on duty alone, then you are perfectly free. Because perfect autonomy for a deontologist, what is so sublime and a value above price itself, of infinite worth in human life, is the ability to act morally. When you act morally, you have set yourself, for Kant, for the deontologist, above all other species. Human beings are sublime because they can act and impose a moral law on themselves from their own conscience, and that is autonomy. Blah, 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 whatever. The point is that then he thinks that when you act correctly, you've achieved something. Humanity itself, freedom itself, fine. But when you're that probably just went a whoosh all over you, but the point is that when you're acting to betray or not to betray, in no sense are you conscious of, well, now I'm not gonna lie to you because then I'm sublime. You don't have it as a goal in any palpable way. You could see that there is some highest thing, acting morally, and therefore being free, but it isn't something that in any way drives you as a goal. It's just something that Kant believes we can come to understand about ourselves to understand our place in the world of other sentient life. So, blah, 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 I'm not sure that's helpful, but that's what's going on when Pettit says in that first page, oh, we all have a theory of the good, and everybody has a relationship of the right to the good.
So this theory of the good, achieving human freedom, that's an individual human freedom? I mean, if I want to act so that everyone can
you
act
can't.
For individual.
As soon as you start that path, you're already consequentialist.
Yeah, so.
Okay. Yeah. I am not trying to maximize your freedom in this way because I couldn't. Because all you have to do is not kick me and you're free. Just don't shoot me and you're free. What am I going to do?
I can teach you.
Huh?
I can teach you to.
We're going to talk about promoting in a minute, but it will not make me free, and here's why. Because, and let's drop the language free, but let's just talk about my achieving the highest good for a human being. It has to be me imposing on me my law. Me. It has to be completely internal. If you push me not to lie, which is a version of promoting, the consequentialism we'll talk about, I haven't acted on the motive of duty. You pushed me to. That's why we've got these now sort of citizen children, but prior we had these nasty little children who, because we were not coercive and were trying to build conscience, were, you know, really kind of hoodlums, and we were losing babysitters right and left or whatever, because coercion isn't a big part of the deontological system. So the idea isn't, now if you lie to your sister, then you'll go to time out. Well, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that with your children. Maybe you should. Maybe you'll get better results than I did. But that doesn't make any sense for a deontologist, ultimately. Maybe we should treat children like that. But imagine if, you know, we do have a censuring system in the world. If you lie on an application, you will not get a job. That's great. That's great that they don't give liars jobs, you know, or whatever, when you falsify records. But honestly, is that the highest good, or is it the case that you would rather have someone who would look at the form and not be thinking, I think I'll lie on this form? Whole different level of morality for the person who's got a coercive reason not to lie, I won't get the job, and the person who's like, well, of course I wouldn't lie. I wouldn't lie on a form. It's not right. When you're trying to go for that sublime act on your own conscience thing, then this whole story about I'm doing it to act free, or you're going to teach me how to do it, or you're going to coerce me into doing it, well, great, but that's never going to be me ruling me. Alrighty, questions?
So I understand that Kant would say, or maybe I don't understand, I think I understand.
What would Kant say?
I think I understand that Kant would say that's, I don't know if subconscious is the right word, but it's not something that you could consciously obtain. You just do it because it's your duty,
right?
And you don't think about it.
Unless you're in a conflict.
Right.
This duty and that duty, and that's when you actually deliberate. That's what Barbara Herman will use the word, you deliberate. Mm-hmm.
But Pettit is saying that it is more overt and understandable.
Mm.
Is that correct?
Because there is no thing called duty for consequentialism. Duty, if they would not choke on that word, and you're going to see Peter Singer use that word without throwing up, because he's just redefined it. Duty is whatever it is that's going to maximize the good. Well, but then you got to figure out what is it that would maximize the good, what would be the best outcome, and then that's your duty. For Kant, the deontologist, duty is defined in and apart, in itself and apart from any consequence that could possibly happen. In fact, the consequences, in an important sense, don't matter, at least in this sense. Something I do isn't right because it made for the best outcome. It's right because it was consistent with my moral obligations that I hold myself to, and then I hope that the consequences work out.
Right, I'm just trying to understand Pettit's description of deontology and how it, in a way, is actually consequentialism.
He doesn't want to say that deontology, he's not Mill.
Right.
He benefited from all the people who slammed Mill's understanding of Kant. So Pettit knows that deontologists and consequentialists are distinct. In fact, when he gets to promoting and honoring, that's where we can really tease it apart. This bit about the good was just because he wanted to have some parallel, but he didn't think, he wouldn't disagree with me that you would figure out, I think he would agree with me that to understand the good of human freedom isn't really that helpful in figuring out the right. The right still has to be understood as whatever duty demands. And then, yes, you'll achieve the good when you do it. But that's a very different mechanism. Here, in consequentialism, you must know what will be good and do whatever it is that will bring it about. In deontology, do whatever is right, and that will inherently bring about human freedom. totally different mechanism. Once again, an equal sign here, even if you do say that the good is human freedom is just another name for when people act rightly. It's the same thing.
It seems to me that deontology is a lot of don'ts, like don't lie, don't cheat, and consequences is a lot of do's, like do maximize
yes,
good.
I like
it seems
that.
Like a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
Is every
it
time I'm refraining from maximizing utility, I'm being
it
immoral?
It has a very high bar. It is a, it, in fact, deontologists will sometimes accuse consequentialism of the over-demanding problem. Like, how do you live? You're always, right? And we'll have to deal with that. And we will in a minute, because Pettit doesn't want consequentialists to feel like they're suffocating from all of the maximizing obligations. So he's going to try to address that very problem. But you are right, absolutely, that when we think about this distinction I'm going to carve out between types of obligations in the Kantian world, in the deontological world, most of the things that you must do that are imperative can best be understood as don'ts. And that's why, once you grow up, you don't end up having to think all that much about your moral life, except in a tiebreaker situation, because you just live your life without, by don't that and don't that and don't that and don't that. You're not actually saying, well, oh God, don't commit adultery, don't break promises. You just live according to, I keep my, you know, I don't, I know that I want to phrase it as a don't. It is the case that I should not lie and I should not this and I should not that and I just don't. So most of the time I'm just living my life. That's true. The Kantian schema starts with a whole bunch of prohibitions. Now, of course, you could turn those don'ts into do's, right? I mean, it's handy to talk about don'ts, but I like the way you put it. But don't lie means tell the truth. And don't betray someone means be loyal and faithful. So you could flip them into a bunch of do's, but either way, they are pretty much just the scaffolding around your life, and they're not really about changing the choices that you make in your life. They really structure what choices you think are actually options. And in that sense, you can live really without doing a whole lot of moral thinking for much of your day. And we'll have to think about how demanding consequentialism is. Now, there's another insight in what you said that you may or may not see. And let me just talk about the perfect duties here, because I think it would be easier than saying that I'm going to do it. Let's just do it. Kant hashes out our obligations in two categories.
Perfect.
The perfect duties, there is no latitude in them. And in the imperfect duties, there's wide latitude, latitude meaning choice. And they break down very simply. There is a perfect duty to self, there are perfect duties to others. There are imperfect duties to self, and there are going to be imperfect duties to others. And your insight actually surrounds this one right here, imperfect duties to others. But let me talk about these very quickly. I don't want to spend too much time on Kant on Consequentialist Week. The perfect duties are those most prominent duties in the deontological system where there is no wiggle room. The duty to self basically boils down to don't kill yourself. I'm not going to tell you why. Two or three weeks from now, I'll tell you exactly why. The duties to others are the multitude, basically, the big mass of duties for a Kantian, and they are don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, don't betray, that whole list of prohibitions. Then there is another set of duties. And we are called to this set of duties because we are one infinitely worthy being in a whole host of other infinitely worthy beings interdependent in our lives. And that sets up obligations to help others. But also, as one of the others, in a weird sense, I am an infinitely worthy being in a sea of infinitely worthy beings, which gives me wide latitude type duties to myself, namely to develop the talents of the being I am. So duties, imperfect duties to self, mostly revolve around the development that I owe myself of myself. And I'll tell you later about why in a couple of weeks. But right now I want to focus on the imperfect duties to others, which basically amount to help others. Now, help others is 1/4 of the system, and certainly not probably not 25% of the obligation. So there's 4 things here, but duty to others is not really 1/4 of everything you owe morally in the world. They don't scale like that. The perfect duties have far more power in the deontological system than the imperfect. But in consequentialism, the duty to others, to help others, to promote their happiness, is basically the whole deal. So you're absolutely right that the do help others and the do maximize the happiness of others is so looming large in consequentialism, but it's only a small fraction of the deontological obligation. And so the scale is very different. Yes, I have to help others, but it's only 1 fraction of what my moral obligations are in the system. And I'm not saying it's 25%, I have no idea how much it is in any particular circumstance or in any particular life. But in consequentialism, the imperfect duty to other is the duty. It's the one. Because that is where you maximize the greatest happiness for the greatest number. That's what it is to promote the happiness of others, to do good for others. That's how Kant names that duty. That's what it is. It's just that for consequentialism, because we are called to maximize happiness, this duty or moral consideration in consequentialism is the whole deal, basically. Now, you are part of that promotion of happiness of human beings. You get to figure in there in a weird way. The duty to self and the duty to others is combined for consequentialism. It's all one big thing. You are one part of the happiness of the whole world. But the focus in consequentialism really is on this duty and not on these other perfect duties, unless, don't lie, will promote the happiness of others. So all these duties in consequentialism that loom so large for deontology are only important if they are subsumed and inferior and guided by the obligation to help others. And that's the answer to why it's so much do in consequentialism and so much don't in deontology. So you're right. Are you with me? Alrighty, so we actually did quite a bit. We got to perfect and imperfect before we got to promoting versus honoring. All right, it's the promoting versus honoring that I think is going to really flesh out this perfect-imperfect distinction in deontology and its absence as a schemata in consequentialism. Let's talk about honoring first. What does it mean, and I'm going to use the word value, to honor a value? Then we'll ask, what does it mean to promote a value? What does it mean to honor a value? Do you know? Did you get that much from the reading? He is very dense.
To act in accordance with it?
Yes. To act in accordance with it, to realize it, or the word in philosophy is instantiate it in your own life, to be the example of it. To recognize it and fulfill it in your own life is to honor. And what does it mean to promote as a distinction from honor?
Encourage others to do it, even if it means that you're not honoring it?
Yes, you can. We'll talk a lot about this. Dishonor to promote. So let's put that over here. And let's make it very simple. To make more of it. To maximize it, the value in the world. To get more of it is to promote it. Consequentialism and deontology are going to radically disagree here about what should come first and what the place or prominence of each is in the framework, in the system. Which theory is going to care about honoring? Right. And obviously then, consequentialism is going to care more about promoting. Right. Because deontology doesn't have a maximizing bone in its whole body. Even when it gets down here to the imperfect duty to others, and it is you are following your own obligation to help others, and that's what you're trying to do, you are not called to maximize what it is that you're doing. So if you decide that you're sitting on the bus and there's some folks there who need to have a seat, your obligation in deontology is to get up and say, would you like my seat? It's not to get on the megaphone. There are three people standing here with a walker. I need three people to get off. There is no maximizing needed. You just do it, whatever it is that you feel called to do to help others, and that's what you do. That's honor. You're never called to promote. Never is a big word, but in general, let's go with never for now. Honor is what you must do. You must honor, especially the perfect duties, no latitude about when and where, always, always, when you honor, to the perfect duties. When it comes to the imperfect duties, you gotta honor, but you got a lot of flexibility about when and how you honor. For the consequentialist, honor will not get you that much in the world, thank you. You actually are called to promote, to get more of it, of whatever value it is. So much so, that sometimes you actually are allowed to dishonor in order to promote. But first, before we do that, let's just figure out why in the system we've got, where we looked at this help others as just one of four categories of duties, promoting isn't even necessary at this one, but this would be the only place where promoting wouldn't make any sense at all. Why? Well, take, for example, the duty to self, don't kill yourself. How are you gonna get more of that? So far, as long as you're not slashing your wrists, you're honoring it. How are you going to get more of it in the world? I don't know. You could be on a suicide prevention hotline. Oh, but that's not the duty to self. That would be helping others, and absolutely you could. What if you were in a duty, so suicide, remember, is the classic example. Don't kill yourself. To others, it's the whole don't lie, cheat, steal, kill, whatever, you know, the whole thing. How are you going to promote that? Don't lie is what I owe to other people perfectly. That's what I must do. So when I honor it, I simply just don't lie to you. Now I could suppose, I imagine you're going to give me a way, and I need you to talk about how we could promote don't lying in others. But it's nothing a deontologist is ever going to say. You must do it. How would you, in fact, it's a little bit of a stretch, right? Because when you try, you're going to help me brainstorm how you could promote these values after I'm telling you that deontologists don't ever try to promote these values, or ever. I mean, that's not what they're demanded to do. They just have to honor them. You could promote them, but as soon as you give me the examples of how you would promote them, you're going to see right away that that's not a typical way that any of us go about dealing with lying, cheating, stealing. How would you, for example, honor don't steal? This is simple, very simple, but let's see if we got it.
Well, you could don't steal?
Yeah, just don't do it. Don't take the watch, or for heaven's sake, the iPod. Just don't take it. Yeah, that's also what helps us understand how easy deontology is much of the time, because you know what? You actually weren't thinking about taking it. Not like you're holding yourself back. Sometimes, maybe, but most of the time, no. So you're just honoring it, absolutely. You're just gonna leave that there. And somebody left his cell phone on Tuesday. I didn't say, ooh. You know, I asked the people in the bus, I had no idea how you get somebody's cell phone. They were like, well, why don't you look in the phone book for something he calls home? Ha, okay. Anyway, it was very easy to honor that. I didn't want the cell phone anyways. I've got an iPhone and he doesn't, whatever. But if I did, then honoring it would be refraining from keeping the thing. Good. Now you tell me, what would it mean to promote don't steal?
What if you did what you're not supposed to do?
Don't dishonor yet. No. Just honor and promote. Honor and promote. Strengthen honor us.
Tell your kids not to steal.
Yes. Yes. You could absolutely get a little more out of it, squeezing-wise, if you told your kids not to steal. That's not too far off. Now, I mean, that's not too crazy. You could tell your kids. You could tell your kids not to lie, not to cheat, not to steal, not to kill, And that certainly would be a kind of promotion. And I'll grant you, it's a nice point. Deontologists, there you go, do promote, because pretty much all of them do say those things, even in the free, you know, wheel kind of, you know, the home I live in. Even I promote that. So, okay, I'll grant you that. Now, beyond your own kids, what would you have to do?
You prevent people from stealing, like detector things that...
Yes, you're the person who creates detectors to make sure that nobody else does, could promote it in the world. Yes, and how many people do that in the room? How many people have that job? Some, right? But not many. It's a good example, but it shows that, well, how come you're not doing that? What are you telling me? You don't create, you know, businesses where there's security systems? And you'd be like, well, no, because, you know, I'm like I'm a neurosurgeon. What? Well, that's right, because for deontology, there's no obligation. That is a nice way to promote, but you're not called to do it. You don't have to do it. Maybe you have to do it in your own kids, and we can talk about that. But beyond that, promotion is a little bit odd when it comes to this set of values. The perfect duties do not easily lend themselves to promotion. Yeah, that's because they're deontological values. Consequentialist values do lend themselves to promotion, and that's why it would be a consequentialist who would naturally talk about promotion, whereas a deontologist would be like, you know, choking, trying to figure out what does it mean to promote the core values. You did it, you figured out some suggestions, but they're a little hinky, they're a little bit stretch. Promoting is not something deontologists care about. They care about honoring. If your goal is to maximize the human good, human happiness, then this is just lazy. This is just morally lazy. Sure, you honored a whole bunch of stuff, but was the world a better place? It's a better place maybe than if you dishonored it, but your honoring doesn't really get us very far. The fact that every one of you resisted stealing that iPod didn't really change anything for anyone in any country in Africa, thank you. So this whole honoring thing, when you're trying to maximize the greatest good for the greatest number, is just the easy way out of morality. It just doesn't do much for the goal of creating the greatest happiness for the greatest number to maximize. So the call in consequentialism is to promote, to get the most out of it. So if you are trying to get the most out of people eating, having their basic needs met, trying to maximize literacy. You know, if literacy is what you're trying to promote, or women's safety, for example, or whatever it is, of course you should try to get more of it. Not just be someone who doesn't beat up on people, be someone who tries to make sure others don't beat up or who protects those who might get assaulted. So that is, I think, a really helpful distinction, not articulated by Mill, but consistent with Mill, that really does flesh out where the obligations are. I mean, we're just at the beginning of this, but really where the emphasis is. I am now going to talk about dishonor to promote, but first I want to make sure that we all have honoring and promoting. Questions on that? Okay. What does it mean, or what, why is, had it, first, what is, what does it mean to have to dishonor in order to promote? Why is Pettit needing to say it? Because I think he does. And when you understand why, as a consequentialist, you can and must sometimes dishonor to promote, I think you'll understand better what the goal is of what you're trying to do morally. So you're giving me an example. Give it to me as a definition, then give it to me as an example. So
to dishonor to promote, okay. Seems like it means you want a definition.
Give me the definition, and then your example and how it.
So to dishonor to promote seems to suggest to not instantiate something in your own life in order to promote it in other people's lives.
To get more of it somewhere else requires you sometimes to thwart the very thing you're trying to promote. And what was perfect about what you said was that it has to be the same value. It's not that in order to save a life you have to lie. That's different, that is a conundrum, but it's not the dishonor to promote. You have to dishonor in your life something, that very same thing you're trying to promote in your life. And now the example of the military will work for this, so how will that get you fleshed out?
So you could make the argument that in order to, you know, you will dishonor the the rule of not killing people in order to promote less death overall.
That's right.
Less killing overall.
Classic example, perfect example. I am trying to get more of saving human lives. You can cash it out the way she did, but I'm going to put it in this frame. We can get more of saving human lives, saving more people, by killing some of them, by not saving them, by actually unsaving them. In my own action, I have had to dishonor the value save lives to achieve the very goal of save more lives. But what if I didn't need to kill a life to save a life? What if I didn't need to kill some people in this village who were unarmed and children in order to save lives? Was that an example of an appropriate dishonor to promote? And here's why it isn't. Let's imagine that if you just honored the save life, didn't kill anybody, you'd get 4 units of good. Utils is the metaphor that utilitarians used to like. And if you just promoted, let me make sure I get this right. So in this case, yeah, okay. If you just honored it, you'd get 4. And if you dishonored and promoted, you would get 12 in this case. But if you honored and promoted, you'd get 16. Because you have all of yours, plus the ones that if you didn't honor, you'd get from the promoting, and when you add them up, you would actually get more by honoring and promoting. If it's possible to honor and promote at the same time, then you cannot dishonor, even if you're going to get more than if you just honored. In other words, if I dishonor and promote and I get 12, that is 3 times more than I would have gotten if I just honored. But if I honored and promoted, I'd get 16. This is a maximizing theory. You can't say, well, 12 is higher than 4. You have to say 16 is higher than 12. I'm imagining a situation where what you're dishonoring isn't necessary for the promotion. In other words, you killed small children. If you hadn't killed the small children, you could still have promoted the goal of 12, but now you would have had the 4 saved from honoring, and now you'd have 16. It's not trying to get the better option. It's trying to get the best option. Now, you might be able to make a case for me that I've got this formula wrong about Vietnam, so that's fine. Ignore that. Let's just imagine theoretically I've got this thing right. Theoretically, then, you can never dishonor when honoring and promotion will do you more good than dishonoring and promotion. Go ahead. Sorry? Oh, you're kicking each other. Good. Okay, so one more time. You must honor and promote in consequentialism, unless there is no way to promote unless you dishonor, which was not this little schema I came up with. I said, if you just honored, you'd have 4. If you dishonored and promoted, you'd get 12. But if you honored and promoted, you'd get your 4 plus the 12, 16. Consequentialism is very strict. It's not lazy in any way. No one would ever say it is. So you can't just say, I'm doing so much better than the lazy deontologist. That's not what you're called to do. It's not beat deontology. It's maximize consequentialism.
Sorry, this is kind of a broad question, but all of these frameworks are dealing with what is just morally obligatory, not necessarily what's permissible, what you should do, but like what you were obligated to do, like that is the right thing, right?
Yes, because I think where you're going is this concept, and we're in consequentialism, so that's why we're not talking about it much, called the supererogatory.
Yes.
This, in deontology, is called obligation. Above obligation is supererogation. The supererogatory. This is above duty. That's why it's called super. Above duty and obligation. It is above and beyond the call of duty. And that is not what you're obligated to do, but what you may choose to do that goes beyond what you must do. This is the must, and that's the could, if you want to. But consequentialism doesn't have an easy way to make the distinction between what you must do and what you could do that would improve the world. There is no above and beyond the call of duty because there is no duty, because duty is that which will maximize the greatest good for the greatest number. And if you're doing that, how would you get above it? You're maximizing it already. There is no above maximizing. If the thing you're going to do is going to get you the most, how could you do something above the most? It's already most. But deontology doesn't care about the most. It cares about the minimum. Deontology cares about doing what is minimally obligatory, and then you can go above that anytime you want. Mother Teresa, whoever you are, Gandhi, do it if you want. But it's a minimal theory, and consequentialism is a maximal theory. So you don't have any way to talk about permissible versus above permissible. It doesn't have the mechanism of supererogation. Okay?
Mm-hmm. So would it be wrong to say that from a deontological standpoint, Mother Teresa is morally better than like anybody who's just doing the minimum?
It went by so fast, say it again, I'm sorry.
Is Mother Teresa morally better?
I mean, some people don't even like her. So forgive, for those of you who are sort of didn't like her to begin with, just imagine she's a metaphor. Go ahead.
She's an angel.
Okay. In fact, she's going to be canonized soon, right?
Is she better morally than someone who just does the bare minimum? Is this supererogatory? Uh-huh. Does that have the same, like, you know, weight that morals have? Or is that, like, just a totally different, like, column in the accounting?
Total different column in the accounting. When you act on the motive of duty alone, you are already sublime. You are doing what needs to be done. Now, we can say in deontology things like, oh, you're a moral hero. But praise for going above and beyond is a different kind of animal than saying you have acted according to the moral law. That is the scale that is to be cared about. Now, do we revere people who do something that is way beyond what we're called to do? We do. But when it comes to the moral law, we're only asked to do this. That we are expressing our humanity itself when we act morally. So if you do something else, we absolutely can respect it and admire it, but we are not supposed to then say, I'm a moral rogue. I'm just a lazy, good for nothing. Oh wait, I'm sublime, thank you. Yes, this is some other extraordinary thing. But think about, for example, the way that you think about firefighters. Now, if you're a consequentialist, you're like, I don't know why you aren't all firefighters. No, just kidding. But you think about, as a deontologist, you think about firefighters. You think, wow, that would never be me, but wow, do I look up to them. But that doesn't mean I don't think I'm a morally good person. I think that's a whole other thing, and I'm not going to do it. That level of calling and service is something I don't feel obligated to do. I don't feel bad for not doing it. I don't hold myself to that. But wow, I really look up to it. It's like that.
So I was going to ask that exact question. I understand how a deontologist would say, I'm not a fireman. There's a burning building with three people in it. I don't have to go into the building. I can if I want to, but it's not duty or obligation. But what would a consequentialist say? I get, they'd sort of just say, you have to just decide. Right? This is one of those situations where there is no right answer. You sort of have to decide because
I think it's different.
You
think
don't
it's
know
this.
You don't know if you can save them if you go in. So it's not like
true.
You can know to maximize.
But that's not how a consequentialist will think about it. You're right that there's always a probability, and sadly in 9/11, no good came out of it except our reverence and admiration after the men and women died. So you're right that sometimes you don't know whether you're actually going to get any good out of it. But that's not what a consequentialist is actually thinking about firefighters. What they're thinking is and then I do have to do, just remind me, we're going to do dishonor to promote, because this was not an example of the necessity to dishonor to promote. Let's imagine that the scale of goodness works like this. Consequentialists will look at a situation like this and they will say, my life moving forward, I can only achieve this. Wow, this would be better. So I am not the person this person is, and I wish I were, and I failed to live up to what someone else could have achieved. In other words, there is a kind of almost perpetual could have done better. So if you have the, for example, if you're a deontologist, sometimes in extraordinary circumstances, or especially when you're reminded in a cute way, you will feel guilty that you didn't give more to the latest earthquake somewhere around the globe. But you will say to yourself, I made a decision that I'm going to give such a percentage of my income, or I'm going to give in such a circumstance, or these are the charities I'm going to support, or whatever. And then, yes, the world's not fair, and that's it. But I have fulfilled my duty to others. You will hear a deontologist say things like this. You know, in every church or synagogue or institution like that, there's always this quest for more money. And you will hear people say things like this. I'm not giving that much money, but I volunteer a lot of my time. That's what I've decided in my conscience. That's what I've decided I'm giving. And no guilt. That's it. Done. Consequentialists can always live up to, can always be more. So there is a kind of, you know, being drawn to that criticism, to being susceptible, and I don't mean in a bad way, because it could be true, that there is an elevation of their giving, of their service, of their maximizing that is possible. But they're not going to define it as, hey, I made a decision based on who I am, where I am in my life, what I think I owe others, what others are giving relative to me, where I am economically, and that's what I'm doing, and that's I'm good with that. That is fine. Consequentialists can always be vulnerable to the, that's it, that's all you're doing. Other people are doing more, 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 more. So consequentialists are more likely to say, I wish I could live up to that, but I just can't. They're more likely to say, Peter Singer's right. We do live affluently. We shouldn't be buying that watch, those Ann Taylor pants, that cruise. We shouldn't be buying the coffee at Starbucks. We should be donating the money. I wish I could live up to that. I totally think that's what one ought to do, but I simply cannot do that. That's not the same thing as saying, I am doing what I ought to do. Other people give more, good for them, but I am doing what I ought to do. Consequentialists are more likely to say, I am failing to do as much as I ought to do, and I'm going to live with that guilt, but I'm not going to change it. So there is more of a burden on a consequentialist. Usually a consequentialist will say, I wish I could do that. I should do that, but I'm not going to. So I am failing to live up to my own values, whereas the deontologist set the bar so low, it's hard to not live up to it. So more likely, when a situation of the burning building comes, somebody might say, I ought to do this, but I'm just there, you know, I'm a coward. I've got to protect my own life. I've got other people at stake. I just am not the hero other people are. It's more of a negation. Whereas the deontologist will say, my obligation is to call 911, and I absolutely will.
But, so since the utility of like a certain amount of money is probably much greater for someone who doesn't have a lot of money versus somebody who does have a lot of money.
Wait till next week, how much money he wants you to give away.
Yeah, doesn't it kind of commit you to giving money away until like the person you're giving money to has the same amount of money as you?
If you had thought of it first, you could have written the very famous paper that Peter Singer did in 1972, but you didn't think of it first. It's his paper, we'll read it next week. You got it. Mm-hmm.
So going back to the dishonoring to promote.
Yes, okay, dishonoring to promote. She's brought us back. We're not going to get away without.
I just had a question about, so it seems
now, like we haven't actually defined it yet, so okay. Let's see if your question is after I define it and then ask it,
but
okay?
I guess,
you're
going to
ask it, go ahead.
It seems like nothing is ever good enough unless you're doing the ultimate best. So
true.
It seems like in consequentialism, you never ever have the situation of dishonoring.
Not true. That's a good lead into how it can sometimes be absolutely the case that you must honor to promote. She just gave us one. Let's imagine that you are in a war where 6 million people have already been killed for their particular religious views, and you have got to kill some people now to stop it from being millions more. You have to.
But like, I guess
you have to dishonor to promote.
In the most extreme case, like, why would you have to kill the other side? You could teach them and help
them. Oh, right. Hitler.
That works for the Nazis.
You don't understand. They're really good people, those gay Catholic Jews. They're great people. Really, I mean, even the just war theorists, even the deontologists, that's why we love to go with the extreme. the Hutu and the Tutsis, the in Cambodia, right? I mean, genocide, in Bosnia. I mean, we can come up with examples where these people are not teachable. Rwanda, they're not teachable. Even just war theorists will have to admit that in the face of genocide, you're going to have to dishonor to promote, right? This is a conundrum. This is actually slam dunk for a consequentialist. This is like, duh, no-brainer. The deontologists are the ones wrapping themselves into a pretzel, but we'll get to that in a couple of weeks. Well, that's a classy example that she already gave us about dishonoring to promote. Now, I want you to help me think of other examples where you would have to dishonor to promote. Think of examples where, if you actually lived the value in a particular moment, you couldn't maximize the value in the world, because your living it would cost too much time, resources, energy, compared to what you could do if you were actively engaged in getting more of it. He gives us one in the book. It's about voting. Go ahead.
Grow my own food.
Grow your own food. Mull it over and think about how you have to dishonor the growing your own food to grow your own food.
Well, if I'm actively engaged in trying to make more of it, get more of it, I would be able to grow my own food.
Ah, okay, I understand. You are on a campaign to buy local. That's your deal. Okay, I like that. So, we're going to have to see if you have to actually violate it, though. I'm going to make it so that you do, but we'll see. So what you want is for people to not be buying kiwi here at all. Because you know what? It doesn't grow here. And what we're supposed to do is buy what grows here. So that if you lucked out and lived in California, you could actually get your five fruits and vegetables easily. But if you live in Philadelphia, you're down to potatoes for most of the winter. But that's your value. So let's go with that. So right now, you want everybody to buy local, buy what's in season, only buy what's around here. But you find the Philadelphians to not be very open to your message. So what you have to do is keep flying to Vermont all the time. And in all that trip to Vermont, where you actually get those people, they don't even get potatoes. I mean, they're living on mutton most of the time, because nothing grows in Vermont, but okay. You keep flying back and forth to Vermont to tell them to buy locally, and you actually do. You get a whole bunch of local. Unfortunately, you're on the road so much that you don't grow your own garden. Okay, it's not exactly a classic anecdote. We did have to work a lot for it, but all right.
It's like how Al Gore is like, you should not like burn all this
yes.
fossil fuels, but
yeah.
I'm just
yeah,
around the
work
world.
That hard for this one. You both got it, but this one sort of just stood there and yelled, right? Exactly. I have my own jet because nothing will get me to as many speaking engagements faster to talk about global warming than the jet, which is adding to global warming. Right, now, should it actually be the case that there was no other way to promote the worry about global warming than to be in that jet, then it would absolutely be the case that you just had no choice to dishonor but to promote. Exactly. Let's use the voting example that Pettit gives. How does that fly? How does that one go? Do you remember it? What you care about is that people get out to vote. That's what you want. You want to get people out to vote. So how would you promote that? Hmm?
Drive everybody to
vote. Yes, drive everybody. Now every time
you don't vote.
That's right. Because every time you fill up your car and get people to the polling place, there's far more people in your big van voting than any time you would be able to get out and quickly go vote. That's just people you wouldn't be able to transport. So that's his classic example, but these two work. But that's the idea that you may dishonor to promote only if, when you dishonor, you actually do get more promotion than if you honored and promoted both. So if, for example, it turned out to be the case, as is in Princeton, that the polls open at 6 or 6:30 a.m., especially when it's a school tax hike, because that's, people want to make sure that everybody gets in there to say yes, more taxes, which Princetonians always say yes to, so that's all good. If you hear about schools, and if you're a senior citizen, you're not sure how good that is, but then you can't afford to live in Princeton, so you left, so it's okay. Those polls are open at 6:30. The only people who are going to be driven to the polls at 6:30 are the people who can already drive to the polls. So your service, thank you, of driving people to the polls at 6:30 is not needed. Go ahead and vote, and then starting at a reasonable time, like 8, 9, you can start carting everybody else to the polls. Let's imagine. Then you may not dishonor to promote. And plenty of senior citizens are pro-school tax. That was just a joke. But anyway, dishonor only if it will enhance promotion. If you could do both, then we can't. It won't maximize to lose the honoring that you would be doing. Thoughts, questions?
Does that ever happen in deontology where it would be okay to cheat or lie or anything?
I have to sit down. It's so, I just to process it.
Wasn't there an example about something, if somebody was gonna, if you were harboring someone and like a killer came and was looking to kill somebody?
That's your classic Nazi save a life or lie case, but that's not the same value.
Because you're valuing one over the other.
Those are two different values. When we're talking about dishonor to promote, it's dishonor voting to promote voting.
What if you have to kill the Nazi in order to save the guy?
Yes. That would be dishonor. Dishonor.
Are you allowed to do that?
Okay, so inconsequentialism, that's just like a no-brainer.
Yeah,
should we assassinate Hitler to stop the genocide?
Yeah.
Duh. Right. Deontologists, and that's what Pettit and other critics of deontology will say, is that what is so clear to a consequentialist will actually require all kinds of hand-wringing from the deontologist, because there's, of course, a prohibition called don't assassinate. So that's why people came up with this concept. If you were with us in the fall, we saw this thing called the just war. And that's the metaphor. What you're talking about isn't quite assassination, but it's of that same ilk. And the idea is that a just war, a just killing, is a very rare circumstance to find oneself in. And the reason deontologists love talking about World War II is, besides Bosnia and Cambodia and Rwanda, those a couple of genocides, and there weren't very many we actually got involved in stopping, there aren't really that many that deontologists feel that they can get in there to say, yes, we should have assassinated that person to stop, you know, the slander. So, for example, you won't find that many deontologists, at least moral theorists, who think that trying to kill Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden is the way to stop terrorism, for example, to stop the killing. It seems good in consequentialists. Some, a lot of consequentialists don't like it either. But it's the kind of thing that can seem so clear, so obvious in by one way of reasoning. But the deontologists are really going to stumble on the kill to save. It could turn out to be the case that's just war is the kind of moment when a military action is justifiable, but the criterion for a just war is the heavens are about to fall. I mean, it's major catastrophe. So, for example, to go in to Iraq on the threat of biological weapons without proof of biological weapons and proof that they were functioning and proof that they were going to be used. I mean, even there's a way of looking at that, and consequentialists wouldn't have liked it either, because on balance, what was the greatest good, whatever. But the idea of going in with military action where people are getting killed, was that the heavens are about to fall? That's a pretty high bar. So the answer is really that deontologists struggle a lot with this dishonoring idea, because the obligation of morality is to honor above all things, even sometimes at the expense of obviously good consequences. Just war theory was an articulation of an intuition or a view, trying to make sense of why stopping genocide through the means of killing people actually could be justified from a deontological perspective. But it actually was motivated by the most extreme circumstance of dying, of others being killed. Short of that, deontologists are in an awful conundrum trying to figure out how it's justified. It's certainly not obvious. And that's where the consequentialists identify an obvious Achilles heel, because for most people, if you said something like, if you killed one to save 1,000, would that be worth it? And the deontologist is stumbling and stuttering, trying to wonder if that's can be understood, because it's not a maximizing theory. And so to dishonor, even in that case, is a conundrum.
You said you should only dishonor and promote if you can't honor and promote at the same time?
For a consequentialist.
But what if dishonoring and promoting give you more utils than honoring and promoting?
You should always dishonor and promote if it'll give you better consequences. Absolutely. But if you would maximize by honoring and promoting, you can't say, well, I got to get out of jail free card here. I don't have to honor. I don't like voting and standing in line. No. If honoring and promoting together will get you more utility, then you get no free pass from the consequentialists because you didn't maximize. Your vote was the one vote short. But if the only way to get the most was to dishonor, then yes.
So how does a deontologist phrase their rationale for saying that killing Hitler and the Nazis is appropriate? Because I keep thinking it is your duty not to kill, it's your obligation not to kill, and they're killing, so we need to stop them from violating that rule, even though I violate it myself now by doing it, but again, I keep going back to that it's for the greater good.
Right.
In the end, what you're really saying is we're stopping them from killing people because more people will live that way.
Uh-huh. No. Just as the consequentialists have a phrase of the day that cashes out their theory, namely the ends justify the means, which the deontologists are like, oh, no, really? The deontologists have one too, the lesser of two evils. But what's different, and you're going to say, well, lesser means less of, not maximize, that's consequentialist too. No. Evil can't be what is less. If you get more good by doing something, it can't be evil. It's what is right. In the case you're talking about, there's not except for the extreme pacifists, and those are like Amish and people, which is great. We love them. But except for them, nobody thinks that Hitler shouldn't have been stopped. Nobody thinks that the U.S. shouldn't have gotten in the war. Nobody thinks the U.S. shouldn't have gotten in the war faster. Nobody thinks that the Pope should have denied what was going on. Nobody thinks that. Military action was done for most deontologists too late. And when it was done, it was justified. And even if it wasn't done for the right reason was genocide had to be stopped. Well, how do they square that? Because it was the lesser of two evils. But it's never going to have been right. It's only going to have been when human beings are put in a position when there is no moral right, then maybe when the heavens are about to fall, you do what is the lesser evil. But you never call it the right thing to do in any moral sense. It was just what Mylander and people like Michael Walzer, just war theorists, say is when our whole moral way of life is at stake, and genocide does that because it denies humanity in a population. What could be more thwarting of the recognition of infinite worthy beings than that? When the heavens are about to fall, you may be in a position morally where only the lesser of two evils is what you can do. Because to stand by and watch it is complicit, to be complicit in a greater evil. But you will always define it as having been an evil. You will not say, well, it produced the greatest good for the greatest number at that time. In fact, if we had gotten in earlier, it would produce even a greater good for the greatest number. And therefore, it was good. A deontologist will say it will never be able to be defined as good. It will only ever be able to be defined as the lesser of the paths of evil that were in front of us. And that's why they'll be hemming and hawing, and then maybe a path going down. It'll never seem good. It'll seem like this. I am pushed to do what is ugly and wrong, but there's nothing else that can be done because there isn't a path that is right. There is no path that is morally good.
If the intro is all about me and that I have to do it and someone
all about me,
that I can refrain from killing Hitler, and the fact that Hitler wants to kill everyone is not my fault. So it seems like it's not really two evils. It's I can be evil and avoid his evil, or I can be right and he can be wrong. But as far as the me argument goes, it seems like it's pretty cut and dry.
The consequentialists have a powerful criticism of deontology, which they call the dirty hands problem. And it's exemplified in this thought exercise called the trolley car problem, made famous by Philippa Foot. And she talks about this conundrum where if you stay on the, you are in the front of a trolley car, and the trolley car has two possible paths, but it's already on one. And if you don't do anything at all, because you're not the engineer, you're just on that car and you're just riding along, it's going to kill the six people that are laying on the track. But you didn't get us down that path. You didn't have anything to do with the fact that these people are about to get run over. It's not my problem. I'm just standing there. I am not committing any act. I'm just standing there. And yes, six people are about to get squished. But if I pull the lever and the track goes this way, one unfortunate person will be on the track, and my pulling the lever will be the causal activity that killed that person. It's called the trolley car problem. And deontologists have been mulling this thing over for 20, 30 years. They don't know what is better and what is worse. For the consequentialists, like, you're kidding me, right? Count. For the deontologists, the very problem of, but I didn't kill. I have to say, I killed him if I pull the lever. And if I let the train go the way it's going, I will have to say, they were killed. And that's compelling to a deontologist, though very difficult. The problem is, and it's not just a numbers game, the commission omission problem is very powerful for a deontologist and trivial or non-existent for a consequentialist. But when you get to genocide, you are not talking just about numbers of people, you're talking about whole moral ways of life, like that you could annihilate a people. Is a different animal from this. And yet, deontologists really struggle because the consequentialists are making a good case here that you got six infinitely worthy beings on the track because you didn't want to get your hands dirty. So what you're articulating is a conundrum for deontology.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, like ending World War II early by dropping the bombs, that would not be a deontological.
No, in fact, Mylander and just war theorists have come down pretty hard on the nuclear bomb in Japan. Yeah. Whereas if you could show that it really did have an on-balance saving of lives, there could be a consequentialist rationale, which is not to say that all consequentialists believe that we should have dropped the bomb, because consequentialists of various stripes will say the ramifications of that went far beyond dropping it there, namely the nuclear arms race, for example. So and I'm not saying that all consequentialists are going to sign on to the, yep, we should have, you know, it's good that we dropped the bomb. No way. Consequentialists and deontologists don't agree internal to each other, with all deontologists saying, well, pull the lever or don't pull the lever. Same thing with consequentialism.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I got to get on to options and prognoses, but it won't be hard. Okay, was there a, did you have a question somebody did?
I thought I did. Is categorical imperative still in play here at all?
The categorical imperative is how we get all of this set.
For deontologists to act so that there's no contradiction in what's what you can think of. If we're talking about how lesser are two evils, and if we take the example of Hitler,
mm-hmm.
The Holocaust, for example,
mm-hmm.
So if a deontologist wants to act rightly, such that everybody else acts rightly without me having to wish everybody else to act oppositely.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of the Holocaust, that there's an obvious contradiction there. And
mm-hmm.
But it's the perpetrators of, you know, all these horrors that are making the contradiction. So if you want to just take the contradiction out of the equation, would that count as the lesser of two evils and doing the right thing by removing the contradiction?
Here's where you're going awry, and we'll talk more about this in a couple of weeks. The categorical imperative doesn't tell you what to do in any particular circumstance. All it does is generate the thou shalt nots. So it doesn't say what to do when two duties conflict. All it does is say thou shalt not kill. It leaves you with that, and it leaves you with thou shall protect human life. But unfortunately, thou shalt not kill and thou shalt protect human life are in opposite, in conflict in the case of, do you stop somebody who's killing willy-nilly in genocide? The categorical imperative gives you these two duties. It doesn't tell you what to do once it's given it to you. So it doesn't know anything about the Holocaust, the Tutsis, the trolley car, the mistress of my partner that I want to kill. It doesn't know anything about that. All it knows is generalized duties. So the categorical imperative is long gone by the time we're stuck with the mess. All right, we're here. Let's talk about options and prognoses. And I'm going to give a little bit of a shortened, but I think we have a lot already under our belt, so we're not going to have to belabor it. Options for Philip Pettit are the actions, the possible actions we could take. Prognoses are the outcomes of those actions. Then we have, does he call it the good? Yeah, the good. Okay, and what he's trying to do here is circle back to what we talked about at the beginning of class. When you're trying to think about your possible actions, you're going to have to think about the possible outcomes, and it's all possible, right? It's all about probabilities, and that's why he gives you, if you don't know probability, then he said if you've got a 50% chance that you'll get 100 utils, and you have a 50% chance that you'll get 0 utils, then probability-wise, you add that up and you get 50. That's because of the way that probability math works. So if you know anything about math, it's 0, it's 50% times 0 and 50% times 100, which is, and then you get 50 and 0 and add it up and you get 50. Blah, blah, it doesn't matter. The point is that when you're thinking about the outcomes, you have to think about the probabilities as well, and you have to think about your various options. But the way that you're trying to decide this is, you think about what it is to what the good is, maximizing happiness, and that tells you what prognoses are best. And that the prognoses tell you which actions are best. And let's put this up as a little bit of a formula just to cash it out. But what he's trying to show you here is that when you're trying to decide an action, the good is what you have to know first. Once you know the good, then you have to do a little bit of guessing on probabilities, and that's not easy. But once you know that, even though you've got only probabilities, then you can decide what action is right. Look at it like this. Action one will mean that you kill one person, but your outcome will be 10 saved and one killed. That's on action one. You kill one, the outcome will be that you save 10 and you kill one. On action two, you kill zero. But in outcome two, one is saved and 10 are dead. To judge what action you ought to take in consequentialism, you simply look at your good, which is the maximization of human happiness. You think about whether you'll get more happiness, all things considered, if 10 are saved and one is killed, or one are saved and 10 are killed. Clearly, it's not even a question that to have 10 saved and 1 killed is the better outcome based on the maximization of human happiness, and then you know that it's action 1 that you ought to do. So you started with the good, which you knew was the maximization of human happiness. That let you judge the outcome, and the outcome let you judge the action, and that is what he's calling the options. So of the available options, the good leads. You think through the possible outcomes, yes, admitting probability, and then you choose the action that will bring about the best outcome that you judge best based on the good. And that's once again circling back to how he said the good decides what is right. And in the end, we can say this action is right and this action is wrong. The deontologist isn't so sure. I'm not saying every deontologist will immediately say that action one is worse, but I know that they're not going to immediately say that action two is wrong.
What if saved is under your actions, though? What if you, instead of just putting kill under the things that as an action,
as a verb,
instead of making it like an outcome, what if saving people isn't Like, what if you count that as an action?
So you reverse.
Does that make
save
sense?
And kill. Save one outcome.
You know, if like one of your values as a deontologist is
mm-hmm.
to save people,
mm-hmm.
if the situation should arise, isn't that also an action? The saving of people?
Well, that's a euphemism. How am I going to save them?
I don't know.
Oh, well, so if I can save them,
it's possible to save them, yeah.
But it's not going to look like this. What I needed in here was some killing. Let's imagine that we don't have this one. I could save one, or I could save none. What do I have to do? Jump in a wading pool to get a little kid out. Duh. Of course, there's nothing I'm dishonoring here. I'm not dishonoring any value at all when I either let the kid in the pool die, then I am dishonoring the value of save life. If I get the kid out, by jumping into the pool, I've dishonored nothing, so of course I'm called to honor the value save. You must be saying something I'm not hearing. Because
yeah,
the reason that this is supposed to be interesting at all instead of a no-brainer is that the deontologist doesn't know if action two is wrong. And for the consequentialist, it's so obviously wrong.
Yeah, I think I'm still thinking about like the card thing about like why they would argue both sides, like which way you should, like the dirty hands issue, like, oh, I just won't do it and then it's not my fault, versus if one of your rules is I will save people, like how that...
Well, so I'm in the trolley car and I could say I saved six by killing one. You know, it's not like you can just say, well, if I just redefine it,
it's not like comparable.
Well, no, because, you know, killing is actually taking somebody's life away.
Yeah.
And you can do a lot of saving without killing, not in the trolley car, but when people are drowning, for example. So you can't redefine yourself out of the conundrum. I think you're asking, if I used a little bit of more sanitized words here, wait a minute, my own action took the life of someone else. I can't redefine this as, oh, I saved 10. Sure, I saved 10 by killing one. Here, I'll even do it. Kill one, save 10. I even use the word save. Here, kill none, save one. Either way, I saved one here and I saved 10 there. It doesn't matter. Because remember what he said earlier about how the funny thing about deontology is it's all about a don't. It's all about the don't. Where did I don't? Don't kill. Where did I achieve don't kill? Here. Yes, I saved, great. But you are not allowed to dishonor in order to promote. So that's a consequentialist strategy that you just gave. What I'm trying to say here, and I think you understand it now, is that this action is so obviously wrong for a consequentialist, and I don't know if it's actually the wrong option if you're a deontologist. But I know that I couldn't, with clear conscience, say this is right. Maybe it's the less of two evils, I don't know, that's the best I could do, but that it's right? How could it be right, says a deontologist. Mm-hmm.
To a deontologist, is the kill, and obviously a violation of a perfect duty to
yes.
others,
uh-huh.
is the save an imperfect duty to others? Like, could you
yes,
say, in deontology, one of them was weighed a lot more.
Yes,
so is that
basically.
Could make it even harder for,
yes,
for a deontologist
basically.
To like number two?
Yes, basically, saving is a kind of imperfect duty, though there are parameters around it, and when there is a true need, like a kid in a pool, and you can swim, and where there's 3 inches of water, you don't have wide latitude. It is imperfect by some mental gymnastics we can talk about in a couple of weeks, but there is an imperative that it's not where you, as a moral agent, should say, well, you know what, I gave it the office. But it is the duty to help others, and that is part of the problem of dishonoring and to promote. But in the case of not being in a competition with a perfect duty when the kid's in the waiting pool, then it's hard to understand how you wouldn't feel that that was actually an imperative. Whereas if you've got to thwart a perfect duty to do an imperfect duty, yeah, you're not supposed to do it.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't the consequentialist option prognosis thing require perfect foresight? Or at least
well, that gets us to the nice conclusion of the day. The first one is the wrong acts for good reasons. You know what Pettit is saying here. He's saying the ends justify the means, so deontologists are worried that consequentialists will be scoundrels because they'll do anything to achieve the end. And his view is, when was the last time you were called upon to kill one to save 1,000? These are very rare circumstances, so he dismisses that, though it is one of the big worries for deontologists. He's like, I don't care. But then he says, you know what? I don't want you to get into some bad deliberative habits, and this is going to be where he ties into rule versus act consequentialism. He does believe that retrospectively, this is how you decide what action was right. Retrospectively, when probabilities are mastered. But foresight.
Things that didn't happen.
Yes, that is true. So you're never going to have perfect hindsight no matter what. There is no 20/20 hindsight. It's absolutely false that there's 20/20 hindsight. It's absolutely true what you just said. But he believes that consequentialism explains why actions are right and why actions are wrong. But he doesn't know if you should take it as your strategy to figure out what action based on prognosis, based on the good, when you're living your life. And for me, that just, I can't make any sense of what he's saying there. He's arguing that you should not deliberate about what to do. You should just live your life and follow your rules and live on, except that every single example he gave here about dishonoring to promote and options and prognoses was square act consequentialism, looking it right in the eye. How do you know what action is right? Based on the prognosis, based on the options. How are you supposed to know what you should do? Well, you should absolutely promote, even if it's dishonor. Every bit of that is act consequentialism. But then at the last paragraph, he's like, yeah, but I'm really talking about a theory of justification, how consequentialism, how the world, how we are to understand when actions are right and when they're wrong. It describes right and wrong action. It doesn't tell you how to live. Well, to me, then it's just a waste of time. What does that mean? So we will find out after we've made bad choices that they were wrong. That's no help at all. So to me, it's once again this problem which act consequentialists, pure act consequentialists, don't actually have. They just say, we're act consequentialists. Yes, it's hard. Yes, you have to decide what the parameters are. Yes, it could overtake your life. And so you just have to say, I can't be a perfect person. I'm just going to have to do what I can do. But act consequentialists will usually just bite the bullet. They won't try to be rule consequentialists. Because what he's really saying then is, if you only know that you did the right thing after the fact because you're not supposed to deliberate based on trying to figure out what action will maximize the good, then exactly how are you supposed to make decisions about what to do? Well, the only thing left would be based on rules. Yes, but then that makes you a rule consequentialist. And unfortunately, being a rule consequentialist will not deliver the maximization of the good in particular circumstances, because you will just be following the rules rather than weighing the best possible outcome. So there's no reason to believe that you will, for example, be able to achieve, that you would even consider action number one if you're a rule consequentialist. Because what would it be that would enable you to break the rule? The rule is kill none. The option that is right on act consequentialism, obviously right on act consequentialism, is exactly wrong on rule consequentialism because it violates the rule, don't kill. Rule consequentialism and act consequentialism have the same at loggerheads character that deontology and consequentialists have. So I have to say that by the time he gets to that last paragraph, I don't know what he wants you to do. In fact, at the end he said, I'm not trying to argue for rule consequentialism, which is what he calls indirect. I am arguing for direct. But I'm arguing that if you think too much about it, you'll get it wrong. I don't know what that could possibly mean. So we should act without thinking? So I love him, but at the end, I think it gets very muddy.
I was under the impression that the whole point of the rule, the utilitarian argument, was it gets rid of the bad deliberation problem.
Yes.
So to go back to like the cell phone example, let's say he had an iPhone, you wanted it, and you didn't know, but his 2-year contract is up, he's going to get a new one anyway. So he's got nothing to lose.
It would have been much better for me to steal it.
So in an act utilitarian says,
right,
you should steal it.
Mm-hmm.
But a rule would say, because you don't know that he's getting that, you shouldn't steal it. Because in general, when people steal that, that diminishes utility. So you should not steal it in this situation because you don't have that foresight or you don't have all the information. That seems very, like,
in
good
fact,
to me.
We can come up with many circumstances where the very thing that act consequentialism would tell you is a no-brainer, you ought to do it, is something that a rule consequentialism would say as a no-brainer, you absolutely ought not to do it. For example, let's imagine that the rule you had was tell the truth, but then you have the Nazi at the door. So what do you do? Tell the truth. Yeah, well, there's no way that's going to maximize the greatest happiness for the greatest number. An act consequentialist wouldn't even consider telling the Nazi the truth. Yes, I have an innocent person in my house. How could you? Unless.
But then I just read a new rule that says I can lie if it saves a life. Bang, problem solved.
Maybe there are ways, but rule, you know, and it could be the case that a rule consequentialist could salvage some of these things by saying, you, Autumn, don't understand the fine-tuning of the rules. But it wouldn't save the cell phone example. What would the rule be?
In that case, if you follow the rule, you would definitely minimize utility in that specific situation. But in general, if people always didn't steal, and you maximize utility
across
the world.
There's no doubt about it. Rule consequentialism has the advantage of, over time, maximizing utility, as we talked about when we talked about what would happen if we all lied all the time. The problem is that in particular circumstances, looking at actions and options, it will not, in particular circumstances, it might cost you utility in a very dramatic way, like in this case right here.
Mm-hmm. What about the examples he gave about, like, you know, living in the moment and not thinking too much, being my goals, like being the good? How can you do that as an act consequentialist?
Yeah, and I think what's funny about his example is that that's the example where you're trying to decide whether if you kiss this person you're very attracted to, and then you're sitting there and you're saying to yourself, will this maximize the good? And then you just have had one thought too many in this situation. But deontologists have a good rejoinder to that. That's actually not a moral situation unless that person happens to be in a committed relationship with someone else. Other than that, that's in the morally neutral. You don't actually have to engage in any kind of moral reflection at all about who you kiss.